Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to another edition of Valley Writers Read. Tonight, we're featuring two writers, both of whom we've had on many times before, Howard Hendricks and Sharon Patterson. Howard Hendricks usually reads one of his extraordinary science fiction stories, but tonight he departs from that in favor of creative nonfiction. The name of his story is American Bacon. Meanwhile, Sharon Patterson's story is entitled Ant Climbs a Molehill Guarded by a Camel. But first, to get us started, here is Howard Hendricks reading American Bacon.
American Bacon. Need you if you're available tomorrow, Friday, just 2 hours. So reads the note I find wedged into the weather stripping between the front door and its frame when my wife Laurel and I return from proctoring the last of our final exams at the university. The note is from Pete, a good neighbor who has helped me with tractor work on our property more than once. When I call one of the two cell phone numbers listed on the note, Pete tells me he needs some help with his pigs the next day at 9 in the morning. His brother, who usually helps him, is just out of shoulder surgery and no good for the lifting work Pete wants to do. Sure, I tell him. Christmas break starts now. I can spare a couple of hours. No problem. When I arrive at his place the next morning, Pineapple Express rain is fire hosing California like Mickey Mouse has gotten hold of the weather wizard's magic hat. Pete's black pickup with its white camper shell is parked beside a large fenced enclosure down the hill from his house. I shout for him, and he appears, dressed in bright yellow construction site rain gear. He waves me down to the concrete apron where he's standing. Two pigs root about in their large pen behind him. "Welcome to Fort Hogg, with two G's. That's what my grandkids call it." He points out the way he's heightened the fences, roofed and tarped the enclosure. The roofing means we won't be working in the rain, but it wasn't against rain that he bunkered the pen into Fort Hogg. That happened after two black bears took four of his young pigs last summer. When the pen's fences were lower, the enclosure was unroofed, and Pete was in Half Moon Bay tending a friend who was fighting cancer. I had already sold those four pigs. The damn bears not only took half my herd, they cost me money, too. 40 years ago, Pete was a standout college wrestler, and he's still built a bit like a bear himself. Notable by its absence is his long ponytail, stunningly free of gray for a man of almost 60. "That's from the Native American part of his ancestry," he says. He has tucked the long braid up beneath the faded American flag bandana that covers his neck. The bandana, in turn, is tucked up under the gimme cap he's wearing. He also wears gloves and boots, all of black rubber. On the left breast of his yellow rain slicker is a small American flag patch. We turn to the two pigs rooting in the pen beside the gate. They are still there, very much alive. Somehow I didn't expect them to be. "After I finish with the gun, Howard, I'll hand it to you. Then I want you to hand me this sticking knife here, and I'll cut the throat so the pig'll bleed out. Got that?" "Got it." "Okay, which one do you want to do first?" "Let's do the bigger one first, that one." "Good eye. The female it is." Pete opens the gate. With studied quickness, he takes up the .38 special. Placing its snub nose against the pig's forehead, he pulls the trigger. Flash bang. The pig goes down. The gun is not as loud as I expected. Pete hands me the .38, and I hand him the sticking knife. Pete slashes the pig's throat, loosing a flood of red-black blood. The pig twitches and kicks in death as we shove and drag it onto the concrete apron. The sight doesn't make me faint or vomit, although at one time I might have thought it would. 30 years ago, in college, I had a job as a bacteriology lab tech and phlebotomist in a large urban hospital. On my first day of training, after watching my mentor have some trouble finding a vein during a particularly hard stick, I fainted in the hospital corridor, not 3 minutes after leaving the patient's room. I've never forgotten that, despite the fact that I never fainted again through all the hundreds of sticks I did the year I had that job. Many were the nights of my childhood, too, when mildewed blankets and forced air dust turned Frankenstein monsters, strangling me until I came coughing and spitting awake in cold, damp dawns, only to face scrambled egg breakfast sliding phlegm-like down my throat. After bumping and rocking in yolk-colored school buses smelling of exhaust and steaming sewer lids, I spewed yellow morning into schoolyard bushes more than once. None of that happens this time. Pete is hosing the blood from the concrete apron and from the pig, too, before the pig has altogether stopped twitching and kicking. At his suggestion, I hose the blood off the sticking knife, then soak it in a container full of warm, soapy water before rinsing it again. When he has satisfied the pig and its environs are clean enough, I help Pete position the pig on its back between two wooden blocks, each about 3 feet long. I give him one of the other knives in his kit, a sharp, angled skinning blade. "My father and grandfather raised and slaughtered their own pigs," he says, cutting through the pig's skin all the way around its left rear leg in a circle just above the foot. "These are their knives." He gets the knife's point up under the pig's skin on that left rear leg and begins cutting toward an imaginary midline. When he's satisfied with the length of the cut, he moves to the pig's right rear leg and repeats the process, cutting the circle again, then cutting another line until he has brought together the lines from the two legs. "This is almost a lost art," he says, continuing to cut, just under and up through the skin, forward on that no longer so imaginary midline, over belly and breastbone, until he reaches the cut he made at the throat with the sticking knife. "Every American ought to know how to do this." I nod, a whole history of frontier self-sufficiency flashing through my mind. He repeats the process at the front feet, cutting in a circle around each leg just above each foot, then cutting a line tangent to that circle, just under and up through the skin, down from each leg to meet at the midline. We return to the back legs. As he begins freeing the skin from first one leg and then the other, he has me move and angle the leg we're working on so as to make his flaying as easy and efficient as possible. Cutting, peeling, and pulling the skin away from the waxy pale fat beneath, Pete is careful not to lose the pink-red side meat as he works around toward the pig's back. Watching the knife cuts interline red lean with white fat as he works, I understand for the first time why American bacon is red and white striped and begin to appreciate the amount of work that goes into making it. We continue the dance of moving and angling each foot as we work on the front legs. Pete is a very experienced hand at this. Before long, he has cut and peeled free all the skin he wants to remove from the front and sides of the pig. He has me fetch a hacksaw. He saws through the breastbone, parting the rib cage, the last operation we do while the pig is still on its back. After I hose, soap, and rinse off the hacksaw, Pete gives me instructions on how we'll lift and turn the pig so we can finish removing the skin and head. Above and behind the pig, just in front of more chain-link fencing, hangs an adjustable steel figure-four frame with a flattish hook jutting out from either end of the four's crossbar. The frame rides on a chain threaded through a block and tackle hoist, which is in turn chained up to a beam overhead. The apparatus looks less like a medieval torture device than something one might find in a shade tree mechanic's work shed. As I feed the rattling chain through the block and tackle, the frame lowers slowly. Pete cuts a hole through the narrow, slot-like section just above the hock in each of the pig's hind legs. When I have lowered the frame far enough, I help Pete lift the pig and slide a hook into the hole slot of first one leg, then the other. We pull on the chain, hoisting the pig, splayed cruciform and upside down, up to a height comfortable for Pete to work on while standing. Working the skin loose from around anus and tail, Pete cuts, pulls, and peels the pig's skin away from the fat beneath. When he has pulled the skin free a bit less than a quarter of the length down the pig's back, he cuts a hole into the freed skin on his side, then another on my side of the pig. "Put your hand through that hole in the skin and use it like a handle. On the count of three, give it a good, steady, downward pull. I'll do the same on my side." He counts to three, and we pull the skin down. I'm surprised at how readily it peels off the back, revealing the hand-broad layer of dimpled whitish fat left behind on the carcass. "If you think that's easy, you should try deer. That skin pulls right off, like a sheet, and rabbits even easier than that." We repeat this procedure, this time with both of us not only pulling down with our hands, but also with Pete pushing down on the freed skin with one knee. We repeat it, hands and knee, until the skin is peeled off to just below the original throat cut. At Pete's command, I hold the pig's head steady, pressing down on the damp, rumpled pig skin, covering the head like a suit coat tossed over the face of a deceased accident victim. With the hacksaw, Pete cuts between the carcass's neck vertebrae until the head is free. I flap open and hold open a large black plastic bag, into which, together, we load the severed head and flayed skin. I put the bag aside, out in the rain. "At least with it cold and wet like this," I say, "we don't have to fight flies." "It's not the flies, it's the meat bees. Do this when it's warm and you have to have one person just to stand guard with a fly swatter. The dang yellow jackets want their share and they want it now." We rotate the frame on its chain until the skinless, headless carcass of the pig hangs with its belly toward us. Pete works carefully in the crotch of the back legs, cutting and peeling, freeing up tendons and fascia. He calls for the last knife in his kit. This one's sharp all around, but not pointed, more of an oval, like a bloated cheese spreader. And with it, Pete works his way into the suture line of the pelvic bone. Eventually, he places the blade's front end against the bone like a chisel and hammers the butt of the handle with the palm of his hand until he hears a reassuring crunching, cracking sound, the pelvic suture giving way. "There, that did it," he says, cutting, peeling, and pulling from the tail end and down the belly. "Now we can really get things moving. Almost done. Here, hold on to this pea sack. We don't want to cut a hole into that and taint the meat with pig piss." I keep the bladder out of harm's way. Pete moves back and forth between cutting and pulling open from the front and cutting and pulling free the internal organs from along the backbone and rib cage. Down the organs come, slumping in cascading shades of gray, pink, white. Kidneys, intestines, stomach, liver, lungs, heart. Freed to where the throat was cut and head was severed, the entire mass at last falls free to the concrete apron. I flap open another plastic bag, and we load the guts into it. Pete shows me how and where to cut the pig's feet off the carcass, and I do the job with the hacksaw. I lug the bagged guts into the rain, then toss the feet into the bag with the head and skin. "Grab one of those fabric donut things there," he says as I come in out of the rain. "They're called Alaska game bags, but we call them condoms." I bring the rolled disc of fabric to where the flayed, gutted, headless carcass hangs from the figure four frame. At the end where the head once was, we begin unrolling the fabric sheath, very much like a giant condom, up the length of the hanging meat. "All right, I'm going to hoist the frame a little bit now. I want you to bear hug the pig like this and lift up on it so it'll be easier to get the legs off the hooks. Don't let it fall after it's off the hooks. Then I'll grab an end, too, and together we'll haul it to the truck." After some initial confusion, we apportion ourselves one to each end of the sheathed carcass and carry it between us to the pickup truck, to the door already open in the back of the camper shell. "Load your end in, front feet first." "That's right. Now we roll on this second condom from the back feet forward." "Okay, that'll do it. All nice and double bagged." We take a brief coffee break, during which Pete talks about how his pigs are clean meat. He knows exactly what they've eaten, much of it gleanings from our community garden and the garden he and his wife Cindy keep on their land. "It'd be cheaper to give them pig feed, but I don't trust those processed pellets. Who knows what kind of hormones and chemicals might be in those?" I nod. We start to work on the male pig. The procedure is the same, the only difference is being that this time the gunshot from the .38 sounds louder than I expected, and because we're dealing with a male and have to take the penis into account, the flaying of the skin and handling of the pea sack is a good deal more complicated. Sometimes outdoor plumbing doesn't make things easier. We don't converse as much on the second one, not only because my learning curve is better, but also because Pete, popping his hands-free earpiece in and out, takes a couple of cell phone calls, one from his wife and one from his friend Vaughn, whom he's known since they met in the service during Vietnam. We continue to work the carcass during the calls, communicating mainly by hand gestures. Soon, the male pig is loaded and double-bagged, too. The bagged carcasses will go to the meat market in Madeira, where Pete will have them put through the final processing, cut into chops, bacon, steaks, and hams, as well as ground into sausage. I haul the bagged heads, skins, and guts into the back of the truck. The meat market takes those, too, for processing into tallow and byproducts. "Thanks for all the help, buddy," Pete says, shaking my hand after we've finished hosing everything down one last time. "No problem at all. You've got some pork coming, remember that." "That's kind of you, Pete. I wasn't expecting any. I owe you for all the help you've been around our neighborhood." "No, man, I owe you. Hey, you going to be at the Christmas party tomorrow? Sure will. See you there then. Pete honks his horn as he drives away up the road, off to get the final butchering done. Back at my car, I strip off my blood-spattered coat and the gloves I've been wearing. I toss them all in the trunk and drive home. Once in the house, I strip off my blood-spotted jeans, working on the stains with cold water before washing them in the machine on cold, too. Despite all that, I seem to smell pig blood all day. As it turns out, for dinner that evening, Laurel and I have store-bought pork chops, both of them flawlessly packaged in plastic. We wonder aloud if there would be more vegetarians in the world if everyone had to personally slaughter and process the meat they eat. Laurel asks me if I can look at pork the same way now after helping Pete today. Maybe not completely, I tell her, but it doesn't affect my appetite. At the Christmas party the next day, we learn that my stint as the slaughterer's apprentice is already making the gossip rounds. "I heard you helped Pete kill his pigs," says Virginia, one of our neighbors from up the hill. "And it didn't make you faint or throw up?" "No, not at all." "Good for you, Howard." I can't say for sure whether it is in fact good for me that I'm not as sensitive to blood as I was when I was younger, or that my gut and head are not as connected as they were when I was a child. As the party goes on, I wonder if, in suppressing the gag reflex of childhood for the long, faintly bitter aftertaste of maturity and age, I might also have exchanged a certain dullness for uncertain feeling. Should I be ashamed of that, or should I be proud?
That was Howard Hendricks reading a pretty explicit account of a butchering session where he helped his neighbor, Pete, butcher a hog. As he tells us, earlier in his life, that particular experience might certainly have resulted in his fainting or possibly even throwing up. Many of us might probably do the same. And while we're in the actual process of butchering, we might well express a desire to become vegetarians. Still, we don't seem to mind heading for the meat department in our favorite grocery store and not thinking twice about purchasing any number of neatly packaged pounds of beef, pork, lamb, or fowl, completely forgetting that all the appetizing meat that we just put into our shopping carts was walking around in somebody's barn not all that long ago. Our next story is written by Porterville resident Sharon Patterson. Her story is entitled, "Ant Climbs a Molehill Guarded by a Camel." Here is Pat Smith to read, "Ant Climbs a Molehill Guarded by a Camel," by Sharon Patterson.
The ants go marching one by one, hurrah, hurrah. The ants go marching one by one, hurrah, hurrah. The ants go marching one by one, the little one stop to suck his thumb, and they all go marching for to get out of the rain. Boom, boom. The ants go marching two by two, hurrah, hurrah. The ants go marching two by two, hurrah, hurrah. The ants go marching two by two, the little one stops to tie up his shoe, and they all go marching for to get out of the rain. Boom, boom.
Ant Climbs a Molehill Guarded by a Camel. Anton Lubbock, affectionately called Ant by his childhood buddies, a name that stuck, never wanted to be the proverbial straw on a lumbering camel's back, never wanted to be the invisible needle in a useless haystack. It just worked out that way. Private Anton Lubbock enlisted in the United States Army on a rainy day in January after being laid off from a job tending the furnace of an antiquated steel mill in Indiana. He was not quite 21 years old, and he flipped a coin as a way of deciding to enlist. The other option was to go back home to his parents' piss-poor farm. "You did real good on your tests, Anton. You have options," the recruiter told him. "You can pretty much decide what you want your future to be." Ant knew. He had always known. He wanted to be the guy who brought aid when a man was injured. The guy who carried a fellow man, on his broad shoulders if need be, to safety. Ant, deep in his gut, wanted to be a hero. He'd seen enough movies to know exactly which training to choose. "I'd like to be a medic, Corporal." "That's terrific," the recruiter said. "We need brave men like you. Sign here." Anton was nobody's fool. "You put it in writing first. You put it on the papers that the Army will train me to be a medic." Anton still had that paper, for all the good it did him. "We have no record of any commitment to train you to be a medic. It's not the Army's recruitment policy to offer that option without further testing." Ant would not have called the aging clerk a camel. It would not have occurred to him, for he was new to government bureaucracy. "Look here," Ant insisted. "It says right on my enlistment papers, medic training." "Son, I don't care if it says you can be God, because you can't. You've been given an assignment to infantry. You'll go to Fort Benning, and you will be a member of the U.S. Army Infantry." Anton wasn't a troublemaker. He sailed through basic training, kept his head down and his nose clean, doing everything he was asked to without griping. Once, when his platoon was on night maneuvers, he stepped into a gopher hole and sprained his ankle. But he just tightened up the laces on his size 13 boot and toughed it out. He wasn't about to look weak or incapable. Now this person was telling him that the Army wasn't going to keep their promise. "Let me take the tests," he insisted. "Go ahead and give me all the tests, because I can be a medic." "You go ahead now. You go on down to Fort Benning," the camel told Ant. "Maybe you can convince them to test you, but right now, to this Army, you are an infantryman, son." Ant was a fine infantryman. He earned awards for marksmanship. He avoided the poker games that stripped men of their pay. He went to church and the library consistently, and he insisted, on a regular and annoying basis to any camel he could find, that he might be a needle in their haystack, but he had the paper where the recruiter had guaranteed him medic training. After 10 months in the Army, Anton decided to try a different approach. He submitted a formal request to his commanding officer to be considered for training as a medical corpsman. When his platoon sergeant heard of the request, he called him into his office. "I hear you're unhappy in the infantry, Lubbock. I hear from my superiors that you are requesting a transfer out of this platoon. They want to know what I'm doing to you boys, that one of my newly trained foot soldiers is eager to turn tail and quit." "No disrespect, sir, but it's always been my intention to become the best medic I can be in this Army," he told his sergeant. "Private Lubbock, while your intention is admirable, it is highly unlikely that your request will be granted." The older man lowered his jaw and peered at Ant over his glasses. "I cannot accept that, sir. I made a commitment to the Army, and the Army made a commitment to me at the time of my enlistment." "Did I hear you right, soldier?" "I didn't hear you right, did I? Because if I heard you right, you just said that your sergeant's assessment of your request was unacceptable. Now you swallow this, boy, because I won't be repeating it. You got as much chance of getting a ticket out of the infantry as an Eskimo has of skinning seals in China. You're my foot soldier, son, and you're going to stay a foot soldier." "Yes, sir," Ant said, not looking at the officer in the eye, but staring at a speck in the wall behind him. "Dismiss, soldier, and you can take this request with you." "No, sir. The request should go through appropriate channels, sir. You just got a hankering to end up in the stockade, don't you, son?" Ant kept his eyes on the speck on the wall. The officer stared at the young man for a long minute and then scrawled his name at the bottom of the form. Ant knew he had alienated the one person who might have supported his request. The days that followed were dreary, the way things get when a man is stuck in a hole that he helped dig. Every few days, he'd think about giving up, throwing that enlistment form in the nearest trash barrel and moving on. He couldn't bring himself to do that. "Life is fair, son," his father had told him, "the same way the weather's fair. You just learn not to plant in the snow or harvest in the rain. You make sensible decisions. Eventually, things work out the way they're meant to. Ant had seen a lot of snow and a whole bunch of rain. He liked warm sunshine better. So one Saturday, when he had a few free hours, he went over to the base hospital and poked around. The hall smelled just like he remembered, clean and antiseptic. He'd only been in a hospital once. He was 10, barely old enough to drive the tractor. His dad never liked going to doctors, but one winter he got real sick with pneumonia. When he could hardly breathe, Anton's mother drove Mr. Lubbock into town, and the doctors put him in the hospital. Ant was only a boy, but he heard the doctor say how if they hadn't got his father to the hospital in time, his father would have been dead by morning. The hospital seemed to a young boy to be the finest place in the world, the smell of it as comforting as his mother's apple pie baking in the oven. Ant got so that he spent most of his free time at the base hospital. If he saw something that needed to be done, like a trash can that was full, he'd just take care of it. The nurses got used to him being there. "Soldier, can you give us a hand over here?" a doctor had asked one day when a lady came in doubled over in labor. "Grab me a wheelchair, down there, by the nurse's station." Anton was glad to help. Later, the doctor told him they were short two orderlies. "Some of these boys are too much for the nurses to handle. You looking to be a reassigned soldier?" "No, sir, Captain. I've requested training to be a medic." "Well, good luck with that, then," the doctor said before heading back to work. Ant didn't know why he hadn't given up hope. Maybe he was just waiting for the weather to change. He continued to work around the hospital when he could. The nurses were always glad to see him. One night, he volunteered to sit with a patient named Dave Conyers, who was delirious, a big man rolling and kicking at the covers and talking to invisible souls on the ceiling. He went back the next night and the next until the man grew calmer and asked him his name. "My name is Anton Lubbock, but my friends call me Ant," he admitted to his patient. "I'm Captain Conyers, and I'm sorry for the trouble I put you through, soldier. I had malaria 13 years ago, and sometimes it rises up in me like a volcano." "No trouble. Just glad to be here when there's a need," Ant told him. "How long you been at Fort Benning?" "I came right after basic last December. I just help out at the hospital when I have some time." You're not a nurse?" "No, I'm not. The recruiter said they'd train me to be a medic, but it don't look like that's going to happen anytime soon." "Well, you'd be a good one. I can attest to that. Who'd you say your immediate superior was?" "Sergeant Kapalski. But I just as soon you didn't mention my spending time at the hospital. I suspect he'd rather I was on latrine duty, if you get my meaning." "I do indeed," the man laughed. "I do indeed. Still, it seems to me the Army ought to be straight up with a fellow and keep a promise." Sergeant Kapalski called Private Lubbock into his office to notify him personally when the request for training as a medical corpsman was denied. "Looks like you're going to be with us a while longer, Lubbock. What'd I tell you? Eskimo's chance in China. So you just put your tail between your legs and do your job. It don't look good to have my men running off. See what I'm saying?" Anton took the news like a thunderstorm just broke overhead. It wasn't what he hoped would happen, but it didn't change anything. "Yes, sir. Can I ask why the request was denied, sir?" Anton looked straight on, engaging the sergeant this time, his jaw set and firm. "All you need to know is that your request is denied, soldier." "May I resubmit at another time, sir?" "You can do any damn thing you're stupid enough to do, boy. Are you going to be stupid because you and I know that you're making me about as annoyed as I get when a private pisses all over me?" Anton didn't twitch or blink. "No disrespect meant, sir. I'm just asking if I may reapply." "You can. You can be denied as many times as there are hours in your day, which just got a whole lot longer and a whole lot harder, son. Dismissed." A copy of the request and the action denying the request eventually appeared in Ant's mailbox. At the bottom of the reported action, there was a list of rationale for the action. Two boxes were checked. Number 3, lack of available space for qualified candidates at this time. And number 8, candidate may reapply. Those checks confirmed everything Anton Lubbock knew in his gut. Lubbock remained a private in the infantry as other members of his platoon were promoted and reassigned. His personnel evaluations did not reflect the caliber of his commitment to the Army or his professionalism or his skill. Other men might have become discouraged. Private Lubbock accepted disappointments as if they mattered to him no more than a gust of wind. Months passed. There were moments, many moments of warmth and sunshine. Ant met a girl and fell in love with that April. They married in June. Georgiana Lubbock was one of the nurses that he met at the base hospital, and for whatever reason, she understood that her husband was going to be a medic in the United States Army with a certainty that matched his own. After his third denial, Sergeant Kapalski called a meeting with Anton. "Private, I hear that you're a married man. Now, as a married man myself, I'm sure you want your bride to see you advancing in this Army, making something of yourself. Now, isn't that right?"
"Yes, sir," the young man replied.
"Like I said, a fellow wants to move on in life. You're coming up for promotion this round. Isn't that right?"
"Yes, sir."
"So I got a real simple question for you, son. Are you ready to be a member of the United States Infantry? Because if you're ready, we can put an end to this. Maybe get you a nice assignment in Saudi Arabia. Let you see the world and advance yourself. That's all I'm asking before I do this evaluation here on my desk."
"Yes, sir. I want to be a medical corpsman in the United States Infantry, sir."
"Get out of my sight, boy. You're as big a fool as you were the first day I laid eyes on you." Anton Lubbock was caught and held hostage by an old cantankerous camel intent on guarding his molehill. Ant was strapped to that camel's back. Somehow he needed the sergeant to want to climb the same hill that he intended to climb. So one Sunday afternoon, he drove over to the base library and signed up to use a computer. He logged onto his Yahoo email account and typed in the email address of his Indiana congressman, Representative Hal Jinks. He wrote about what the recruiter put on his enlistment papers and how he had expected the Army to honor that promise to him. He only wrote six sentences. The last one said, "As of this date, my immediate superior, Sergeant Kapalski, has not supported my request for special training." The private knew that there was little chance that Representative Jinks would ever see what he had written, but he didn't know that the representative was a member of the House Armed Services Committee, and that, in that capacity, the representative had an attaché assigned to his office to deal with matters pertaining to the military. If he had known, he might have seen that even an insignificant haystack gets turned over once in a while just so mold doesn't set in. And sometimes a needle does fall out, to the surprise of the camel standing guard. The call, when it came, was from Sergeant Kapalski. "Get your ass over here! 1400 hours, sharp!" Kapalski's office door was open. The small room was crowded. Sergeant Kapalski was fresh-shaven, and his uniform was as stiff as his smile. "Come on in, son. Come on now. We got some mighty good news for you." One of the visitors, a civilian, stood and held out his hand. "Private, I'm your congressman, Hal Jinks. Nice to meet you."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," Ant stammered.
The big man standing in the corner of the room stepped forward and offered his hand. "We've met before, Private Lubbock. I wasn't very good company then." They shook hands, and Captain Conyers put his hand on Ant's shoulder. "Private Lubbock took good care of me when I was billeted over at your hospital, Sergeant. He's a good man. He's going to make the Army a hell of a medical corpsman. Don't you agree?" Dave Conyers' smile was as big as the man was large, and he winked at Anton as he handed him his new orders. "You're going to be up in Washington for a few days before you go to Kansas, Private. You've been invited to give testimony before the House Armed Services Committee. Just a review we've been conducting on Army recruitment policies. I'm sure the sergeant will make those arrangements for you. Right, Sergeant?"
"Anything you need, Captain Conyers. Yes, sir. We'll get it done."
"The malaria got me assigned to stateside duty, Private Lubbock. I've been up in Washington, attached to Congressman Jinks's office. Maybe I mentioned that when I was here."
"No, sir, Captain. I never could have guessed such a thing."
"Then it was just good timing for both of us."
"I'm grateful, sir."
"No need, soldier. We're just doing what the Army said they'd do. The rest is up to you." Anton never meant to climb over a molehill on the back of a camel or be the one needle that sifted out of a haystack. It just happened that way. It doesn't pay to underestimate the ants of this world. Some of them will find a way to become a hero.
That was Pat Smith reading Ant Climbs a Molehill Guarded by a Camel by Sharon Patterson. As we heard, it's a story about Anton Lubbock, who turned out to be the ant. He signs up in the army to be a medic. He even got that in writing from a recruiter, but somehow the army reneged on its promise and made an infantry soldier out of him. He repeatedly tried to get reassigned, which irritated his sergeant no end. It's Captain Conyers, an officer whom Anton had helped earlier when he was ill and who was now a big shot in Washington, who finally tells the sergeant that Anton is to be trained as a medic, so that the ant finally got his way. Of course, having once been in the infantry myself, Anton needs to consider himself mighty lucky to pull that one off. We want to thank both of our authors, Howard Hendricks and Sharon Patterson, for their fine stories tonight. Howard has probably been published more than any other writer on our show. To begin with, he's had 6 novels published by prominent publishing houses. Some of these have actually been republished, and in addition, he's had numerous short stories published in leading literary journals. As for Sharon Patterson, she's a prolific writer of both poetry and prose who was awarded the North Carolina Writers Network Fiction Award. She's also the founder of the Porterville Poetry Workshop. So we want to thank both of these fine authors for their contributions not only tonight, but over the years. We hope they're still enthusiastic about submitting their work, and we look forward to new stories from them in years to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next time, our writer will be John Frank. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.